also to Sarah for inviting me to this meeting. I'm just resurfacing from producing our own report, which is on climate change and development, so I probably am not going to do full justice to Roberto's report, as I'm still recovering from that experience, which is not one I'm familiar with, and I'm happy to get back into this kind of topic, which is where I did most of my work in UNCAP before joining DESA, but also is much more of a familiar DESA topic. There's no doubt that the report is both relevant and timely. It's relevant because despite all the talk of green shoots that one has been hearing in recent weeks, there remains a lot of doubts about the direction that economies both north and south are moving in. And I think it's very important, a point that the report insists on, I think it's an incredibly important point, is that essentially we're in the middle of what looks more like a permanent, what I think is referred to somewhere as a permanent crisis. This is not something that has suddenly happened with the collapse of Lehman Brothers, although that has certainly exaggerated and intensified a number of destructive processes. But this is very, very much feels like a permanent crisis for many countries and many communities across the world. And I think that making that point in the way the report does makes it very important and relevant. And it's timely, I guess, at least from a UN point of view, because there are a series of UN processes to which the report speaks, in a sense. There's the follow-up processes to the UN conference, and we still don't know where the direction those follow-up processes are going, and it's very important that the civil society continues to follow that and to try and push those processes in the right direction. And as Roberto said, there's a beginnings of an exercise by the UN Secretariat to monitor itself the impact and consequences of the crisis. We have set up something called GIVAS, which I always thought was a brand of Scottish whisky, but turns out to stand for the Global Impact and Vulnerabilities Alert System, I think is what the acronym stands for. And as Roberto also said, we have our already Voices of the Vulnerable that was published, I think, last week or the week before. And I guess that is work in progress. But it will be very important, I think, for institutions and networks like Social Watch to follow that and to make sure also that continues in the right track. I just hope that we don't hear a stream of speeches from Bono and other characters and believe that's the way in which that kind of report should go. I think there are three things that I liked in particular about the report, and let me just say what those are quickly, and then three concerns that I'll finish on. I mean, the three things I liked about the report is it's clear that the report does not see the problem as the challenge of the bottom billion, which is often how this kind of challenge is approached. It's conscious of the fact that we're talking about systemic problems and that we need to understand the kinds of pressures and vulnerabilities and threats that countries and communities face as systemic problems. And as a consequence of that, those are not problems that are confined to developing countries. And it's very pleasing to see in a report that developed and developing countries are treated as a whole, and the problems that they face are in many respects common problems. And I think that's it's refreshing to see that in a report on this subject. So that getting away from the narrow definition of poverty and the bottom billion and the informal economy and thinking systemically, I think, is very important. The second area where I think the report makes an important contribution is it clearly recognizes that distribution matters. And the links between distribution and other economic processes are going to be key to finding solutions. I mean, people often forget. I mean, financialization and rising inequality were mutually supportive processes over the course of the last two decades. There's a tendency to see inequality as somehow an unfortunate consequence or a kind of unfortunate side effect of good things that were happening in the global economy over the last two decades. we've never seen it in those terms, certainly not in UNCTAD. And the rise of international finance and the growing inequality that was intimately connected to that, we now realize was both not only unfair, but was unsustainable too. And the need to recognize the mutually destructive elements of financialization and rising inequality, which I think the report does, is an important contribution. The third thing I liked about the report was that it was not so much concerned about counting poor people and monitoring poor people. It was about monitoring policies. If you're going to come up with a serious analysis of what went wrong and what needs to be done, you need to examine very carefully the kinds of policies that are being introduced at both the national and the international level, and I think the report makes an important contribution in that area. So those are three things I very much appreciated that the report was trying to do. I have some worries which I think are embedded in the report, and I'd just like to flag to Roberto and to the audience. They're not so much criticisms as things that were thrown up as I read the report as best I could in the time I had. The first worry that I have, kind of reading the report, is that I think despite the ideological defensiveness of market fundamentalists, and the last 20 years has been an era of market fundamentalism, in my opinion, there's not really an alternative out there. And this is Keynes has made a comeback. Minsky, who is an esoteric economist, even amongst economists, has made a comeback. Polanyi is now on every university social science reading list. Even Marx is kind of made a kind of bit of a comeback, at least in some countries. So there's a kind of easing of the there's a broadening of the ideological spectrum. But I don't think there's still a sense that finance has got away with its behavior. There's still not the sense that there really is an alternative to the kinds of policies and strategies that have been pushed over the course of the last couple of decades. And when people now are talking about reining back excesses, they're as much worried about government spending as they are about the behavior of international financial markets and institutions. The worry now is that in 20 years' time we'll have an unsustainable deficit, therefore we better start planning to cut back that through what is a predictable series of responses in terms of worrying about the size of of the pension system, the stability of the pension system, and various other social provisions. So that's a big worry that, I mean, I must say I'm still not... For a non-orthodox economist, it's always pleasing to see when the heterodox economists are at least taken seriously. But it's not clear that we, as non-orthodox economists, yet have an alternative. There are elements that the report points to. Policy space, for example, and the need for policy experimentation is now recognised as a necessary part of any sort of reasonable strategy. At the same time, there are not local solutions to systemic problems. I mean, the point about policy space is that you give more. You take more seriously the local pressures and conditions that politicians and policymakers face, and that's incredibly important, and certainly the Washington Consensus denied it, but there are not local solutions to systemic problems, and we still don't have the kind of systemic frame. I don't think we have the systemic alternatives in place. There's obviously a lot of talk in the report about human developments and human rights, and that's important, though I have my doubts about basing an alternative around that, but that's a longer discussion that we might have somewhere else. There's also talk about regional responses. South-South cooperation is obviously back on the agenda, particularly for developing countries, and there's the beginnings of interesting discussions about policy alternatives around that, but it doesn't really coalesce into a real systematic alternative, and that remains a worry for me. The obvious one, in terms of an analogy, and my second point, is of course people talking about a New Deal, and that's become a popular rhetoric. That's become popular rhetoric in newspapers and for politicians. I mean, the three elements of the old New Deal were reflation, redistribution, and regulation. Those were the three R's that made up the New Deal. It's not clear to me that there is political pressure certainly in the advanced countries, that are really pushing for those elements to coalesce into an alternative strategy. You've seen, we've got bits of every, I mean, the stimulus packages are themselves defined in those terms, but I don't think it's on the kind of scale that you saw in the United States in the 1930s, and it doesn't coalesce into an alternative yet. And that's because there's something missing at the, not only at the ideological level, but I think at the political level. And the third point I would make, and I guess it's a question I throw out to civil society more generally. Despite the fact that civil society is stronger today, I think, than it's ever been, at least in my memory, it doesn't provide the countervailing power to big politics and disconnected politicians. I just don't see, despite the work that is being done by civil society, despite the attention it draws to things that would otherwise have gone neglected, I don't think it's capable of providing that countervailing political power. And that is a big worry, given that countervailing political power is what is now needed to push alternatives to getting back to a business-as-usual strategy, which is where I fear we might be in 2 or 3 years' time.